Let me start by saying that this sermon has some difficult content. Some content that you might not want your child to hear, some content that you may want to talk about afterwards. I am ready to talk today after service or whenever you are ready. Organizing what we see in the world, as in our time for all ages, what we understand to be the world, is a lot of what we do as humans. In the time for all ages, the rabbi's students wanted to organize the world into mine and somebody else's, or discernible colors. We feel the need to answer the profound question, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable, to help us organize the world. We give people political and religious labels, and we call ourselves Virginians or Americans or other such categories that help us organize the world into comprehensible groups. The same can be said for congregations. Ministers amongst themselves talk about congregational size or theological focus. Concepts like diversity and welcome come up. Those classifications, too, help us understand churches. Sometimes groupings or classifications of this sort are used to pull us away from others, to differentiate ourselves in a way that leaves us or someone else feeling other or not included. And sometimes talking about this type of categorization lets us work better together. I'm thinking about Myers-Briggs, where understanding that I am an extrovert and you are an introvert helps us work better together. Or in a congregational context where congregational life experts call, such as George Bullard, tell us that each congregation has four organizing principles within it. Each congregation has individuals who are mostly focused on one of these four valuable and important qualities. Each congregation has all four of these tasks to do. The four are visionary leadership, growing relationships within the congregation, programs that the church might offer, or accountably managing the church. Yes, four emphases that together lead a congregation to work harmoniously and provide the worship, pastoral care, social justice activities, and other programs that each church uniquely offers to those who attend, that let the congregation live into its best self. So let's talk about vision. Visionary leadership is present when a congregation has a strong and passionate sense of identity involving mission and purpose. Vision allows a congregation to know what their core values and vision are. What is the direction of their spiritual journey? Vision, in this sense, lets the congregation know who it is, what it values and believes. It answers the question, where are you headed? Ideally, it even points towards how the congregation is going to get there. Vision is cast by the leadership and owned by the membership. That's one of the qualities. Now on to relationships. This is about personal experiences around faith. This is where beloved community, pastoral care, and spiritual growth lie. It's about people relating to one another, but it is also about worship, connections to God or spirit or whatever members see as larger than themselves. The quality of relationship provides opportunities for spiritual growth and service. The quality of relationship is what makes a church feel like a family, as this one so often does, and in the best sense of the word. And perhaps sometimes in the more problematic senses of the word. Relationships provide much of the substance that holds a congregation together. Programs are the functions which support relationships, the actual doing of worship services, religious education, book groups, covenant groups, and potlucks. This area includes connections to wider religious community and society, and social justice work lives here. Programs are the framework in which relationships play out. Programs can be for one cohort, like an age group, or for those with a common experience, like caregivers or divorced folks. They provide structure and continuity. They provide spiritual depth in a way that the church reaches its goals and achieves its visions. And then finally, management. That is the system and structure through which programs are made possible and the congregation can change and grow. Management allows for the fulfillment of vision and the implementation of programs and vision. Management administers the church's resources to allow implementation of the church's vision, the building of relationships, and the implementation of programs. Without any one of these four elements, a congregation is hobbled. Indeed, one metaphor for a congregation looks at it through the lens of organizing principles is that of a car, hence the cover of your order of service. Vision, drive. Looking at this car, vision is in the driver's seat. Relationships navigate and are in the passenger seat. Programs support relationships and sit behind the front passenger seat. Management sits behind vision and helps it out. So, looking at the cover of your order of service, we see Barney is vision in this case, and Fred is about relationships. He is Barney's best friend, after all. And supporting them are the two back wheels of program and management.
Thank you.
our anthem. Wow, thank you, that was so beautiful. It asks for one day where whispers of love live inside my heart, where there is freedom and justice, one day when we can open our hearts. So we've got this car. Barney's driving, Fred in the passenger seat. I always loved how they propelled their vehicle with their feet. Yes, this goes back to my childhood. And those Flintstones vehicle stopped with their feet too. They were just like so amazingly direct drive. But where are they going? What is their vision? What is our vision, and how do we decide what the next right thing to do is? As people, as a congregation, as a state, as a locality, as a nation. I love the quote, though I don't know who said it. Your vision will become clear only when you look into your heart. Who looks outside dreams, who looks inside awakens. Yes. One day, the anthem asks for one day, and then a week, and then a month, and then a lifetime of opening our hearts. I want to argue today for the importance of love as a decision-making tool, as the source of vision for action, maybe even the decision-making tool for personal life and maybe even congregational life. I remember a long time ago, back when I was a congregant, I hadn't even thought about being a minister. Well, maybe I had, but I hadn't admitted it to myself. Somebody said, what is Unitarian Universalism about? And I said, I decided to try a new answer. You know, there's this concept of the elevator speech, and I tried this one. We try to make our social justice and life decisions by focusing on the most loving response. Our slogan at the time was standing on the side of love, and when it comes down to is a decision of how to act, we try to do just that. We try to side with love. Let's say that we are deciding whether to support those seeking asylum from oppressive regimes or recoiling into a more xenophobic stance, a stance where we reject people from other countries just because they are from other countries. No, no. We stretch ourselves to act with love. When we need to decide whether to support our transgender friends using the restroom that corresponds to their gender identity, the answer is the loving one. Of course, they must use the restroom that affirms their identity and humanity. One can use the same, what I'm calling, heart logic to get to decisions on whether to support prison reform. Of course, we need to create a fair and racially unbiased system. So my elevator speech went at the time, and there is still merit in it for those issues and for the issues today. How can we use love as a decision-making tool? One way I think is to see things from another person's point of view. I'll even say from the point of view of the person with less power, from the point of view of the person seeking asylum, from the point of view of the person seeking to use the restroom that matches their gender, from the point of view of the victim of the sexual assault. And now we are to the point, which is why I said that some people may want to talk to me after the service. This week has been all about Judge Kavanaugh and the woman who accused him of sexual assault 30 plus years ago, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. Some of you, with whom I'm Facebook friends, have seen that I, too, was attacked long ago here in the D.C. area by three boys at a party. I was a high school student, and the boys were drunk or high or both. I did not fear for my life, and I escaped from them by biting one of them hard enough to draw blood. Their upset over what I had done led them to all swarm to the bathroom and see how bad the bite was, and I was able to escape. I am fortunate that the experience, while traumatic, has not had a major impact on my subsequent life. But I know the party culture, the sexism of boys in the schools in the 70s and 80s in this area, the power of alcohol to distort judgment, and I personally believe Dr. Ford. And I believe that the idea that Judge Kavanaugh's life will be ruined if she is believed is hooey. Rather, he will still have a darn important job for life, a well-paying, stable job with a lot of power. Not many of us can say the same thing. I don't know if any of us can. His life would not be ruined, and her bravery in coming forward has put her life and her family's life at risk. And I will also say, has given me bravery to step forward today, and other women as well. A piece in the Washington Post caught my eye as I was mulling over those experiences from many years ago. It was by one of the speechwriters who crafted words for a senator who voted to put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. The speechwriter hoped that his boss, a Democratic senator, would believe Anita Hill's accusations and vote against Clarence Thomas. Indeed, his positive vote, the senator's positive vote, might have been decisive. But the boss voted to put Clarence Thomas onto the Supreme Court, and it was this young speechwriter's job to write an explanation for his boss's vote that he personally didn't believe. Indeed, he didn't even believe that his boss believed it. The speechwriter wrote in the Post recently how he felt when he was asked to write the explanation for his senator's vote 27 years ago. Quote, "For a moment I thought of storming out, but I didn't have the courage, just a mountain of student loan bills. Instead, I wrote some gibberish about the long and storied presumption of innocence." The speechwriter now says that he has come to regret his giving words to a senator who voted to put someone on the Supreme Court who the writer believed was a sexual predator. His editorial, that is the speechwriter's editorial, was written as a letter to today's speechwriters, all those working on the Hill. He told them that if they believed Dr. Ford, and should they work for a senator who votes for Judge Kavanaugh, and should they be asked to write a justification of that vote, it will likely haunt them, as his decision to write a justification has haunted him for 27 years. He sums up what he wished he'd said to his senator as, "Believe in something." He didn't say it, but that's what he wished he had said. Yes, believe in something, and let that something be the power of love as a decision-making tool. Create a vision, let it be of love as the power to guide us. So, love as a decision-making tool. Love as a decision-making tool. Love as a guiding light. As Ursula K. Le Guin, that fabulous theologian, wrote, "Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread, remade all the time and made anew." Yes, just like anything worthy or holy, you have to knead and shape and form love. Love has to be baked and used to nurture our spirits, strengthen our resolve, and let us make the next right decision.